This is Writer's Voice, airing on this station and on the web at writersvoice.net. We talk to writers of all genres about matters that move us and make us think. Welcome to the show. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.
Human behavior has just always been the most interesting thing to me, and in a very moving way. And so as a storyteller, I'm telling stories about what I see as what it means to be human.
That's novelist Elizabeth Strout. We'll talk with her and Adam Mansbach about their new fiction today on Writer's Voice. Elizabeth Strout's new book, Olive Kittredge, uses the short story form to create a novel about the inhabitants of a coastal town in Maine. The central character, Olive Kittredge, shows up as a major or minor character in many of the stories, as the reader gets to see her from several points of view, that of herself, her family members, her neighbors, and former students. A teacher in the local school, she's known for her abrasive manner, but she's a complex personality with much compassion as well. Strout explores the complex humanity of all her characters as they evolve over time, revealing checkered depths of light and dark. Elizabeth Strout, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you.
Your book, Olive Kittredge, this is a wonderful collection of stories that I would say focus around one main character, but not all of them do. They take place on the coast of Maine, yet they really explore an interior landscape that is completely universal. I didn't feel that they were about coastal Maine.
Right.
But nonetheless, tell us a little bit about the setting within which these stories take place.
Well, I'm always interested in time and place and, you know, the character being a product of time and place. So the place is almost a character in the sense that this craggy coastline of Maine and the main character, Olive Kittredge, the central character, Olive Kittredge, comes from many generations of Maine on both sides of her family. And so she is a true Mainer, and that, I think, does have something to do with the development of her personality, or the development of her reactions to the world about her and to change and the different people that are coming into her town from out of town more and more. And so I'm very interested in how, you know, the world is changing and how these small towns in New England are changing, and Olive Kittredge sort of embodies a lot of that.
This is an unusual way of doing a work of fiction, some place between a novel and a series of short stories.
Exactly.
Could you talk a little bit about why you chose to do that?
Right. From the very beginning, and I started with Olive Kittredge a number of years ago, I did write at that time one story. I think the first story was the one where her son is getting married for the first time and she steals her daughter-in-law's bra and shoe, I believe, during the reception. And that story, I think, was my first encounter with Olive. And I knew immediately that this was the woman who was going to have a full book. There would be a book of Olive. And I think I also understood rather intuitively and rather early on that it wouldn't take the form of a traditional novel with any kind of linear beginning and end, because I saw her as such a forceful figure that I think I sort of understood the reader would need a break from her and that it would be very interesting to see her role in the community and to see her character from different people's points of view, which always interests me anyway, how we see only from our own point of view. And so I was very interested to give the reader glimpses of her from other points of view. But at the same time, it does, for me, it feels that it is a novel. It has the heft of a novel. It is the story of this woman's life.
And say more about Olive. You say she's a very strong character. That's certainly true. And also a character with many different aspects, many of which really only become fully realized in the reader's eye as the book progresses.
Right. That's right. And that's another reason that point of view, I think, you know, to tell the tale of other people in the town and to have Olive make her entrance sometimes in a larger way, sometimes in a smaller way, helps the reader to see Olive in many different lights, because I think that that's how we are all seen. The people that we're closest to think we see, you know, they we think that we see them and they see us in a big way and a more understanding way. It's not always true. You know, it takes a lot of different snapshots for, you know, to begin to get any sort of understanding of what is a personality, what is a character.
And did that happen for you with her?
Yes, absolutely. In the story Starving, I think, where she comes across that girl who is ill and has such an immediate and compassionate and very open response to her, that, you know, it took me a little bit by surprise as I was writing it. I wasn't in, you know, it was nothing planned out. It's not that I plan out very much of these stories or any of my work, but I was sort of surprised and happy about seeing Olive respond that way to that young girl.
And in fact, responds with great compassion, not only to that young girl, but also in another story that's early on in the book.
Right, to the young man, yeah.
There's a young man who comes home to do away with himself. That's in the story Incoming Tide.
Right.
And that's really the first time you get an idea of Olive as somebody who is quite deft and perceptive.
Yes. Yes, exactly. And that she's actually, I mean, it's certainly up to the reader to take whatever experiences they bring to that story and interpret it however they want to, but I think that there is the opportunity there to see that Olive is, you know, she's no dope, this woman, and she's playing this very, in many ways, very straightforwardly, and in another way, very carefully.
Tell us more about her. For listeners who haven't read the book yet, how would you like to introduce Olive to them?
Well, I think she's a real piece of work, I think. And I think that, you know, many readers have said, oh, she just irritated me so much, but then I ended up, like, loving her. And so I'm glad to hear that response because I certainly spent a lot of time with her. And I think, you know what, I think she says all the things that some of us don't ever want to say and never will say. And I think that she behaves in ways that are pretty poor and pretty obstreperous at times, and yet there's something about her, there's some element of deep humanity underneath all that crustiness and underneath all her irritations, and I think she's just quite ferocious in her emotions and in her needs, and she's sort of goes and gets what she needs without too much apology, and yet she does, even much later on in her life, she is still open to learning and evolving.
And she actually even says at some point later in the book that she suddenly realizes how desperately most people are working to get what they need.
That's right. That's right. And that would certainly include Olive.
We're talking with novelist Elizabeth Strout about her most recent work of fiction, Olive Kittredge. She's also the author of Abide With Me, a national bestseller, as well as other books and short stories. You know, there's another minor character in the book who even doesn't really come out much but reminds one of Olive and yet does not have her depth or compassion. It's in a story, the one in which a man develops this relationship with Daisy. Harmon. That's
the hardware store owner, Harmon. That's the story called Starving, yes, where the young girl is ill in that.
That's right, and his wife is a kind of a paler version of Olive Kittredge. Could you say something about the two in contrast? I mean, is it just that his wife is not somebody you wanted to discover, or do you think she also has the same depths, or is she just not a very nice person?
Well, I think that we're not really entirely sure, because that story explores It's Harmon's story, really. It's Harmon's story of a male version of the empty nest. You know, his sons have grown. He's left feeling much more bereft than he expected to, with the kids gone, and he doesn't really understand. You know, he thought maybe his wife would be the one with the empty nest problems, but in fact, she seems to be doing quite well, and she's quite active in this nest. So I think that it's really Harmon's story, but the aspect of that wife's standoffishness, I think that we really don't know what her particular point of view is in that. And at the risk, and it's a genuine risk, of talking again about time and place, there is a certain quality at times in New England of a taciturn nature. And I'm very interested in a region of the country where people are not necessarily all that comfortable talking about their interior lives. And so I think that I see Bonnie, Harmon's wife in that story, as someone who has not really, she's not necessarily been raised in that way. She's had a bunch of boys, they've gone and left. She's been, we assume, a good mother to them. So she's not necessarily, because of who she is and where she lives and what her entire cultural background is, somebody who's necessarily going to be able to share with her husband at that point in her life what's going on. And it's very sad.
He, in fact, falls in love with somebody not because of the sexual attraction between them. I mean, he's a middle-aged man. He's
right.
Not particularly attractive
no.
himself, and neither is his, I can't really say
Daisy,
it on the
right.
air, his blank buddy.
Right, right.
But he falls in love with her because he is able to begin
exactly.
to reveal himself and her to him. Could you talk more about that process and how did that plot development come to you?
Yeah, that was very interesting to me. I didn't really plan on that. Like I said, I don't have a very conscious idea when I sit down. I did, you know, I saw Harmon in that first scene sitting there admiring this youthful couple and feeling, you know, the sadness of the loss of his children having grown. But he doesn't know that he's headed for any particular crisis. And so as I unfolded the story, I began to understand, which I've often thought anyway, that talking, because when he starts to talk with Daisy, when they stop briefly their sexual affair and just decide, you know what, we're just going to talk, that's when they really do fall in love. And I've often thought that talking is actually very sexy, and that talking is a powerful thing. And particularly in this region and this situation where this man simply did not have, you know, once the commotion of having four boys in the house goes away, then one really hopes and needs or would assume that there'd be a chance for real conversation, but in that case there's not. And so it's the talking, it's the sharing of the, you know, the childhood, you know, we all want to be seen, we all want somebody to know those little details about us that nobody else really knows about or cares about. And that's powerful.
And that's what really makes us feel loved.
Yes. Yeah, I think so.
Now, it seems that you really dive down into the interior life. Kind of, you remind me, as an author, of Persephone, kind of going mm-hmm. where few will go into the land of Hades, but there was such a compassionate heart. I mean, I found myself... I have to admit it, I found myself weeping
mm-hmm.
at
mm-hmm.
some of these stories.
Many people have said that, yeah.
My guest is Elizabeth Strout. We're talking about her latest book, Olive Kittredge. It's a selection of short stories. It's a novel in the form of a collection of short
right.
stories. Now, Olive ages through the book. You follow her into her 70s. Could you talk about how does she develop in this way? What are her accommodations with life?
Right. Well, certainly during that time period, she suffers losses, as we do. You know, the accumulation of losses is something that one can truly shudder about if we think about it too much. We don't, obviously, we don't want to think about our lives that way. We want to think that we continue to gain, whether it's, you know, Harmon wanting his grandchildren or, you know, that there's an abundance to life that is wonderful all the time or perhaps available all the time. But Olive is... she is going through losses. She loses her son first to the first wife, and then the wife moves him away, which astonishes her because, again, at this time and place, it's not unreasonable for Olive, or at least she doesn't feel that it's unreasonable for her to think that her son will stay right there, because at that time and place, many people did stay right where they were born, and he had a nice setup, and he had his parents, and he was really kind of supposed to stay there, but off he goes to the other side of the country, then gets divorced, and then gets remarried, and ends up in New York City, and so this is a tremendous loss for her. It's her only child, and then, of course, she loses Henry first to a stroke, and then ultimately to death. And so the bafflement of having been someone who has been, you know, she was a teacher, she was in charge of a classroom, she was in charge of her family, she was kind of in charge of her husband, she was certainly in charge of her son, and this is all taken away from her bit by bit by bit in her particular aging process. And now you know from having read the book that she's going to actually be able to handle this ultimately. But it's a difficult ride for her, because she, I think, like most of us, we, you know, these are abstract ideas of loss until they really hit. And then it's sort of like, oh, you know, what do we do? What are we going to do? And then, of course, when I say that abundance is always available, I think that, you know, she understands that there is ultimately a choice to be made.
A choice?
Well, a choice to either to live in isolation or to join forces with other people.
You mentioned her son. There are a number of stories in which the relationship between them appears, but the two central ones are Little Burst, which is his first marriage, and
right.
then Security,
right.
which in some ways I found that was one of the most powerful in the book for me. In this, her son gets to tell her
right.
how he sees her.
Right.
Talk about that a little bit, how he sees her, how she takes it, the dynamics of that interrelationship.
Yes, that was a very, that was quite, I guess in a certain way, that's sort of my favorite story, or I feel most affection toward that story or whatever, but it's again, it shows the complicatedness of Olive and her relationship to her son. She goes to New York to visit her son, who has married somebody with two children, and he's about to have his own child with this new wife, and she's sort of hopeful and optimistic after first arriving there, even though she's not particularly charitable in her thoughts about the new daughter-in-law, but that's Olive. But nevertheless, she's beginning to think that this is going to go in a certain kind of way. And then it's just by that small act of finding out that she's dribbled ice cream down her and that her son and daughter-in-law haven't told her, that she feels humiliated. And so this one little act becomes, in her mind, huge and emblematic of the fact that she does feel humiliated. She feels that they have dissed her, you know, by not sharing with her. You know, it makes her feel old. It makes her feel out of control. And then she begins responding the way we assume she has sometimes in the past, because Christopher, who has had therapy, tells her things in a whole different kind of language than she's ever heard him speak before, and it's just crushing and very baffling and very, very frightening to her. And it's quite a story, I think, in a certain way. Maybe I shouldn't say that, having written it, but I...
absolutely the most stunning story for me in the book, and one of the reasons it was because it just... There was so much truth being said there
yes.
between them,
yes.
and it was such a shock, really, for her. And I wasn't even quite sure. I mean, he's had therapy, and she kind of looks upon that suspiciously.
Right.
Oh, I see. That's why he is being able to talk to me
right.
that way.
Right.
But for him, you sense that it's a real healing.
Right.
And yet I wondered if there was a point, had he yet reached a point where he could be compassionate? Was he really seeing her fully, or just seeing one side of her?
Exactly. I think that's a very good question, and it's, you know, it's raised and not directly answered. Again, I think every reader brings to it what they, you know, bring of their own life's experiences, which is why, to a certain extent, all these stories would be different stories for different readers to some extent. And I think that, you know, I was very, very conscious of not. I'm not interested in choosing sides. I'm not interested in who's right and who's wrong. I mean, the behavior in that story is, from an objective standpoint, deplorable on both sides. And yet, I wasn't interested in taking sides at all, just interested in saying, oh, my God, look what we do to each other. Look what we do when we're frightened. Look what we do when we're angry. Look what we do when we're confused. Look at how well we can hide from ourselves the pain we inflict on others.
Exactly. And you yourself, I mean, I felt at that point, I could feel your compassion for all of us in a way.
Yeah.
You know, just in that sense, look what we do, and none of us intend to do it.
No, we don't.
For those
and
reasons.
Most of us really don't. You know, we're just sort of doing the best we can and you know, kind of making little messes as we go, and that's life.
And is that the sense that you feel is at the heart of your work?
Yeah, I can't really necessarily put into words, but I'll try. I love people. I really love people. I've always found people fascinating, and they break my heart. I love them, and I think they're so brave, and I think they're cowardly, and I just, you know, so human behavior has just always been the most interesting thing to me, and in a very moving way. And so, as a storyteller, I'm telling stories about what I see as what it means to be human.
I wonder if you would read to us the
sure.
last page of the book, because I think that really does express some of what you just said.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. So I will read the last page when she has decided to go and visit this other man who is widowed himself.
And we should say at this point she is widowed and she's in her 70s.
Yes, okay. And so is he. And they've had their own disappointments and losses. Okay, so the last page. What young people didn't know, she thought, lying down beside this man, his hand on her shoulder, her arm. Oh, what young people did not know. They did not know that lumpy, aged, and wrinkled bodies were as needy as their own young, firm ones, that love was not to be tossed away carelessly as if it were a tart on a platter with others that got passed around again. No, if love was available, one chose it or didn't choose it. And if her platter had been full with the goodness of Henry and she had found it burdensome, had flicked it off crumbs at a time, it was because she had not known what one should know, that day after day was unconsciously squandered. And so, if this man next to her now was not a man she would have chosen before this time, what did it matter? He most likely wouldn't have chosen her either. But here they were, and Olive pictured two slices of Swiss cheese pressed together, such holes they brought to this union, what pieces life took out of you. Her eyes were closed, and throughout her tired self swept waves of gratitude and regret. She pictured the sunny room, the sun-washed wall, the bayberry outside. It baffled her, the world. She did not want to leave it yet.
Elizabeth Strout, thanks so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
Very much my pleasure. Thank you so much.
And now we talk for just a few minutes with novelist Marissa Silver. She'll be coming to our area next week, and we wanted to give you a sneak preview. Her novel is The God of War, and she tells us a little bit about it. Marissa Silver, we just have a few minutes with you here on Writer's Voice. You're coming to the Odyssey Bookshop on May 13th at 7 p.m.
Yes, I look forward to it.
We're just going to let our listeners know a little bit about your new novel, The God of War. And first of all, I just want to ask you, why this title?
It's called The God of War because the main character is a young boy named Ares, who is the God of War, although it's not about that character. Ares is a boy living in the desert in California in the late 1970s. And he lives in an area called the Salton Sea, which is a very odd, off-the-grid, interesting but bleak place. And he lives with his mother and his younger brother, Malcolm. And his younger brother, Malcolm, is mentally impaired. And the story revolves around Ares' desire to break away from his family, his desire to grow up and become an individual at the same time that he feels burdened by the responsibility for his brother. So it's really a story about love and family and how far we responsibility goes in family.
And there is a sense of deeper responsibility that he feels. He feels in some way responsible for his younger brother's condition.
He does. His mother, who is sort of a little bit of a leftover hippie and somewhat mistrustful of the world around her, has chosen rather to sort of get her younger son help and diagnosis. She has chosen to protect him and not really explore what exactly it is that's wrong with him, and so it's left to Ares to try to understand it, and what he believes is that it's because of something that he did.
And now, the god of war, I mean, there must be a metaphor here. His name is Ares.
There must be a metaphor. Find the missing metaphor. Well, you know, it's really about the battle that this young boy goes through to find himself and to find where the boundaries lie between himself and his family and his responsibility. And I guess, you know, in my mind, those sorts of battles are waged, and even personally, not just politically, and that they are kind of a war for your sense of self and your sense of individuality. At the same time that this area in the Salton Sea, at the time that the book is about, in the late 70s, there were staging grounds for bomb drops. Well, it started in the Second World War when the area was closely modeled after the North African desert, and so they started to do, you know, practice bomb drops there. So Ares is surrounded by this constant threat of war.
Now, why did you want to write about responsibility? I take it that this is kind of the central theme.
Well, I find that moment in childhood incredibly poignant, you know, that moment where you have to sort of reject the thing that you love and the thing that makes you feel safe. And I just find that an incredibly moving and dramatic moment of development, and I really wanted to take this particular boy and see where he would go. And, you know, with his very, very unique situation, it's not every child's situation that he has this kind of sense of responsibility for his own sibling. So it's just a very sort of provocative time of life to me, and it was very rich dramatically.
Now, just one last question, not so much about this book, but about, this is a novel,
mm-hmm.
and you got a break when you got a short story published in The New Yorker, and then, in fact, the New Yorker fiction issue of mm-hmm. 2001, was that correct?
Yes.
So tell us, for those of our listeners who are writers, and we have at least a few of them, what for you are the big differences between sitting down to write a short story and writing a novel?
Well, they're both really hard. That's the thing that's similar about them. I guess the difference is that a short story is really sort of it's about compression. It's about how can you make a picture of a whole world in as few strokes as possible. And so it has different challenges. I mean, with a novel, you can, you know, ruminate and really dig into the thought process of a character. And in a short story, you have to get all that same story value across, but without following those rivers of thought. So it's really an incredible challenge. I mean, I guess it's kind of like making a miniature. But, you know, at the same time, what you're trying to accomplish is no different. You want a fully realized world and fully realized characters.
Well, thanks, Marissa Silver, for talking to us ever so briefly about The God of War. You'll be coming to our area next week at the Odyssey Bookshop in South Hadley, and we welcome you to Western Massachusetts.
Thank you so much. I really look forward to it.
Marissa Silver's new novel is The God of War, and it's published by Simon & Schuster. Next up, we talk with Adam Mansbach about his novel, The End of the Jews. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. My next guest, Adam Mansbach, explores the porous boundaries between cultures as well as their continuity. He's also interested in those who see themselves on the margins, like artists and writers. His new novel, The End of the Jews, centers around the relationship between two writers, a grandfather, Tristan Brodsky, and his grandson, Tris. Through its characters, the novel also explores the relationship between Jews and African Americans and the fluid nature of cultural identity. Mansbach was the founding editor of the pioneer hip-hop journal Elementary of the 1990s, and he also worked for the legendary jazz drummer Elvin Jones for several years as a roadie. He's also the author of Angry Black White Man. I started out our interview by asking him about the title of his newest novel, The End of the Jews.
To me, the notion of The End of the Jews is really about the changing notion of community and the ways in which we see ourselves in relation to family, in relation to really any kind of group. To me, the end of the Jews is really the end of sort of easily identifiable pat notions of community that people can sort of easily and uncritically fit themselves into. And certainly, I think, for every community, whether it's familial, whether it's religious, whether it's ethnic, there are always margins. There are outskirts. And on those outskirts are the people who feel ambiguous, who feel ambivalent, who feel slightly disconnected, who feel excluded, who feel that for whatever reason they cannot sort of come more fully into the bosom of community. And those margins are really interesting for me because I think that they are where art happens and where creative thought happens. And certainly if you look at, you know, the Jewish community or communities, I should say, over the course of the 20th century, the people who we really valorize and think of as the great artists, the great writers, really all lived on those margins. People like Philip Roth, Saul Bellow, Norman Mailer, Alfred Kazin, Lenny Bruce, Woody Allen, all those people were very much marginal. And I think a Jewish identity lends itself to this kind of ambiguity because there are so many different ways of being or feeling Jewish. There's the ethnic, the historical, the religious, the cultural, and there are a lot of ways to feel excluded, a lot of ways to feel ambiguous, so those margins are very well populated. And this book really is about people in and on those margins.
And Jews, of course, have been on the margins of the cultures in which they've been part of ever since the diaspora. But when you think of yourself as being on a margin, it's in relationship to a larger community. So tell us a little bit about the Jewish communities. Let's just start with the one in the Bronx during the Great Depression. You have your first protagonist, Tristan Brodsky, who is a writer. It starts right out there in the Bronx during the Great Depression. Say something about that community that he's from and that in some way he's fleeing.
Yeah, well, Tristan is a real when in Rome, do as the Egyptians kind of guy. He's consistently going against the grain. And the community into which he's born is that of a first generation. His experience is that of a first generation American. His parents are immigrants. And the expectation put upon him as a sort of searingly brilliant, young, newly minted American is to be a doctor or a lawyer, make a great deal of money, and lift his family out of the relative poverty which they find themselves in the Bronx in 1935 when the book opens. Tristan is 15 and about to begin at City College, having whizzed through high school in a couple of years. But he quickly decides that he's going to go his own way and become an artist, become a writer. And also he's going to sort of shy away from the political dramas of the day. City College at that time is this intensely political cauldron where the lunchroom is dominated in alcove one by the Stalinists and alcove two is the Trotskyites, and they spend all day arguing with each other. So politics is kind of the new religion, but Tristan is very much an atheist, kind of believing only in himself. And throughout his career, throughout his life, he'll be very much unwilling to give in to the veneration of the Jewish community, unwilling also to give in to the ire that he provokes in that community through his books. He's really intent on telling the stories that captivate him and claiming the right to be captivated by anything and everything. So he's resistant to being labeled as a Jewish writer, whether this comes in the form of respect and book sales, or whether it comes in the form of criticisms of him for writing things that are seen as outside the purview or the boundaries ethically and morally of what he should be writing about. In the 50s, he writes a book in the immediate aftermath of the Holocaust, which chronicles the voyage of a Jewish-owned slave ship to America with a hold full of shackled, soon-to-be-enslaved Africans.
And tell us why that creates such a problem in the Jewish community, that book.
Well, the question that's put to him by critics and reviewers is how, at this moment, in the immediate aftermath of the greatest horror the Jewish world has ever known, can he write a book that is seemingly so out of step with the sort of morality of what the times demands? And his response is that it's absolutely necessary for him to write the book because to understand evil in the world, one must first understand evil in oneself, in one's community. So to him, it's essential to point out that the Jews have not always been the prey, but have also been the hunters.
The themes not only of culture and marginality, but also the ambiguities of culture. One of the characters in your book is the grandson of Tristan Brodsky, also a writer. He's a hip-hop artist. He's taking on another culture that is not one that is that he was born into, as are all the, well, maybe not all the major characters of the book, but certainly he and another young woman in the book who is Czech. Mm-hmm. Let's step back a little bit and talk about these characters, all of whom are in some way playing out other identities, other cultural identities than their own.
Yeah. one of the things I'm really interested in exploring in the book is the interplay over the course of the 20th century between black and Jewish artists, particularly black and Jewish communities in general, but particularly the intimacy of one-on-one relationships between artists and the notion of cultural borrowing and interplay and the line perhaps between appreciation and appropriation. And I think, you know, blacks and Jews have a fascinating history that's very long, very complex, sometimes fraught with a lot of tension, sometimes with a lot of beauty, whether this is manifesting as Al Jolson singing in blackface in the 20s, the Duke Ellington Orchestra being pulled off of a train in Nazi Germany in the 30s and being told by the soldiers that they play nigger Jew music, whether it's the letters being exchanged between Saul Bellow and Ralph Ellison in the 50s, or the Civil Rights Alliance of the 60s, or the way that alliance falls apart in the 80s as Jews sort of pull out from their investment in that struggle. And for my characters, the question of identity is really emblematic of what I see as one of the stories of the 20th century, which is the ways in which a Jewish identity, as it becomes more mainstream, in many ways relies on the immutability of black otherness to make that transition. And so my characters in particular, Triss, who's a hip-hop kid, Nina, who is able to get out of communist-era Czechoslovakia by sort of getting a job and fleeing the country with a black American jazz band, or Tristan himself, who has a sort of complicated relationship not only to the black American art form of jazz, but a relationship with a particular musician who he sometimes finds himself using, wielding as a weapon. His association with this man becomes emblematic of his own ability to step away from his own culture, and he flaunts this sometimes. So I'm interested in exploring all of those things and the ways in which these cultures come together. I think, you know, when I was talking earlier about marginality and the paradoxes and the complexities of a Jewish identity, I think a lot of those things hold equally true for an African-American identity for some similar or at least connected reasons. The kind of dislocation geographically that leads Jews to identify as Jewish rather than, say, as Polish. This history of exile and of movement. The same is largely true for African Americans because of the pernicious historical effects of slavery. You have a dislocation, you have an identity which is both widespread but also hard to sometimes fit into. And so I think there are historical moments of connection between these two groups of people. And a lot of my characters take inspiration from these cultures and these art forms which are not their own. So there's a lot of borrowing going on, and because I'm writing about a family of artists, it happens on a couple of different levels. There's the notion of Jewish artists borrowing from black culture, and there's also within this family a lot of borrowing on a person-to-person level. There's a lot of artistic cannibalism happening, especially between the elder Tristan, who's a novelist, and his grandson, Triss, who will also go on to be a novelist, but when we first meet him is a graffiti writer.
We're talking with Adam Mansbach about his new novel, The End of the Jews. He's also the author of Angry Black White Man. Well, say more about that. Say more about that borrowing. And set us up a little bit. Tell us a little bit about Triss and the relationship that he has with his grandfather, Tristan Brodsky.
Okay, well, so Triss, we first meet when he is 16 in 1989. And of course, I should mention that he is the namesake of his grandfather, which is in total violation of the customs of Jewish culture. You're not really supposed to name children after living relatives. So this indicates something about how, outside of the cultural mainstream for a Jewish family, this particular family is. Nobody in this family is religious. Usually multi-generational Jewish stories are all about assimilation, and that's not my experience, and it's not particularly interesting to me. So in this book, everybody from the oldest generation on down is not religious, is conflicted about their identities, finds themselves surprised in the ways that their identities are wielded by them and against them throughout the course of the book. So Triss, the younger, who at that point calls himself Risk, which is his graffiti name, is DJing suburban bar mitzvahs in Connecticut. And this is not what he hoped would happen when he bought his turntables. He was thinking that he'd be playing much hipper parties. But these are the only gigs he seems able to get. And his signature song at these bar mitzvahs, which he plays to open each party, is a song called Why Is That by Boogie Down Productions, which had just come out at that time. And it is a song which uses biblical chapter and verse to break down lineage in service of the argument that Moses was black. But he and his grandfather have a very kind of unique relationship, and there's a lot of artistic interplay between them. In some ways, the old man is revitalized after a particularly nasty bout of writer's block and a kind of retreat into himself, a retreat from his family, a retreat from his career. The energy that he gets from Tris, his grandson, and particularly the notion of graffiti, kind of jumpstarts his career. So there's a scene in which Tris shows up at his grandfather's house. They begin talking about graffiti, and then the two of them take a walk to a train yard and actually go and write on these freight trains together. And it is sort of this moment of rejuvenation for the old writer. And eventually he will go on to write a book featuring graffiti, which will kind of trump the novel that his grandson has been working on at the same time. They'll essentially both publish novels dealing with graffiti and dealing with some of these artistic manifestations, and it will be this sort of triumphant return for the old man, and it will be a moment in which the ambitions of the younger Tris will be sort of thwarted, and he will sort of turn in a new direction, having felt that he's the victim of identity politics, having felt that no one took his graffiti novel seriously because he is a white kid from Connecticut. So Tris will then be inspired in his sort of bitterness and in his feeling that identity politics have victimized him to go a whole different way and really write about things that are more immediate or will appear more immediate to a reading public and a critical public, and he'll embark on a novel that's really all about his family and ends up sort of putting a lot of family secrets out in the world, and then there'll be consequences for that. His grandfather will essentially disown him, and his grandmother, who has been sort of the victim of her husband's ambition and selfishness for 60 years, will feel amazingly vindicated by this novel.
Yeah, and it's really it's a fascinating development here because, yes, he does start out writing a novel about a culture that he's participated in but is not his own, one that he's taken on. You mentioned before the difference between appreciation and appropriation. He ends up appropriating his own family's history and very much from his grandfather's point of view, appropriating his life.
Yeah, exactly. In the quest to find something that no one can deny is his, and also out of a certain kind of resentment for his grandfather, I think. You know, his motives are sort of complicated. He writes this novel which is incredibly hurtful to his grandfather.
Is there something about the success of his second book, the younger author's book, that needs that pain to be attached to it, that kind of anger, those kinds of emotions to make it better?
Well, I think it's complicated. I think a lot of it comes from something that Tristan, the old man, says to Tris after his first novel is a flop. He tells him that the book he's written is too neat. It's not full of enough anguish. It doesn't take enough risks. It doesn't stare hard and long enough at the most painful things in life. It doesn't attempt to take all of the things that the author loves and find the darkness in them, nor does it find all the things that are dark and find the light in them. You know, so Tristan really, I mean, even down to the advice he gives his grandson, is very committed to this notion of paradox, of complexity, of everything in life being twinned, of no emotion being unambiguous. And he really tries to push his grandson toward a sort of fuller and harsher and in some ways more honest writing style and style of thinking and living. And of course, the irony is that this kind of living, this kind of writing, has really ruined his life, ruined Tristan's life. Nonetheless.
Why is that?
Because it's such a process of intensity and rigor that it has effectively isolated him from his wife, from his family. He's a guy who, at every turn, has put himself and his career first. He's very much ensconced in his head all of the time and really refuses to compromise himself artistically so that life can kind of intervene and intercede. So he's really made choices that leave him isolated, choices he regrets, although perhaps not enough to really, you know, do things differently if he had a choice. So he's sort of advocating that his grandson follow him down a very dark and isolated path, but one that potentially leads to artistic output that is great. And Tris, the grandson, sort of takes this advice, but with a twist that the old man wasn't expecting. When he told his grandson to find something he loves and then find the darkness in it, he didn't dream that his grandson would take him as his subject.
A lot of this book is about writing, about what it takes to be a writer. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that. What were you working on or with as you were developing these issues in the book?
Well, you know, a lot of these things are things that I struggle with myself, the balance between this kind of commitment to the work and a realistic engagement with the world. These are things I think about all the time, things I worry about. And, you know, in different ways, things I've seen play out in the lives of people close to me, whether they're artists, writers, musicians, people committed in different ways to consuming work. You know, the work of an activist, the work of a painter, all of these things, I think. Anything that folks do that requires, you know, that you don't clock out at 5 and clock back in at 9 and not think about in the intervening hours, I think these issues become very pertinent.
But there's also a lot that's very specific to being a writer. There's a certain point in the book where the old man, where Tristan is talking to Tris and asking him about noticing.
Yeah, you know, I think there is a lot about the artistic process in the book. There's also, you know, a lot of sort of interplay between these artists. Tristan and Amalia's romance is largely an epistolary one. They're exchanging letters, and the letters are not really about much else besides their work. They are writing back and forth about poems, about chapters of a novel. Their love letters are essentially manuscript pages covered in red ink. And they build up this private sort of language about language, and it is enough to sustain them through at least many years of a marriage. When all else falls away, they still seem to have this connection based on language. I've never had a romance like that, but I do enjoy a very kind of old-school relationship with my editor, the kind that you read about, you know, Hemingway having with his editor or something. I've been working with the same editor for 2 books now, and the amount of time that we spend going back and forth, writing each other, talking on the phone about the characters, the plot, the book, arguing, resolving, I think in some ways, strangely, although I don't think I even realized it at the time, that process probably was in some ways the guide for me in crafting these letters, this epistolary romance between these two characters. That kind of intense scrutiny of work where the characters become like friends that you're discussing, you know, I think is very, to me, is really precious and kind of a unique thing.
And more rare. And we're talking with Adam Mansbach. His new novel is The End of the Jews. He's also the author of Angry Black White Boy and Shackling Water. I'd like to go back to the book itself now. We briefly mentioned, but I'd like to bring her up a little more centrally now, the third protagonist in the book. And this is a young Czech woman, Nina. She's also 16 when we first meet her. And eventually she and Tris do connect with each other. She has grown up in a culture where she doesn't even think of herself as Jewish, although she is. Tell us a little bit about, you know, her background, where she comes from, and how does she get in with these black musicians and this culture? Why this character in this way?
Well, Nina, when we first meet her, as you say, is in communist-era Czechoslovakia. We first meet her around 1982 when she's a young girl, and we follow her in this particular chapter until she's about 16, 17, and is able to find a way out. And she doesn't, you know, she's Jewish on her mother's side, but in, you know, communist-era Czechoslovakia, religion really was not something that was permitted, and she doesn't grow up with any sense of herself as Jewish. So while, you know, in America, the a-religiosity of the Brodsky family is really a matter of choice, for her it's more a matter of safety. And she is the child of academics who have been plotting an escape from the country for some time. And eventually they execute a plan which involves her father leaving, getting a travel visa, and going to America for a conference. And the idea is that he will not return and that Nina and her mother will join him and they will reunite in America. But the plan goes wrong, and instead her father disappears. And she and her mother are trapped in the country. They're being besieged by all kinds of government agents who want the house in which they live, which has not been subdivided, so it's a really attractive piece of real estate. And they are essentially sort of in this really difficult position, and her mother is really stressed out, and Nina begins to kind of have to take care of herself, and she begins to take photographs as a way of sort of framing the world. And this becomes her way of dealing and making sense of what she sees. And she will eventually meet this American jazz band traveling on a State Department tour, and she will latch on to them, and they will get her out of the country. The irony of her departure, of course, is that the Velvet Revolution will happen like less than a year in the future, so had she waited, she could have just waltzed out of the country. So she's sort of taken on as an assistant photographer by this band, who are traveling with a photographer. So Nina becomes the apprentice to this photographer, and for the next several years of her life is traveling through America on a bus with this band of black American musicians and being inculcated into that culture. And part of their acceptance of her involves a lot of joking that she is too soulful not to have some black blood in her somewhere. You know, a few generations back, she must be at least half Creole or something. And Nina, in attempting to figure out, you know, life and culture, and also as a complete outsider to America who doesn't really understand what the legacy of being black in that country means, will take this on herself and will start to accept the mantle of blackness that's kind of being offered to her, so much so that she will eventually apply to college and check the box marked for black applicants, and in fact win a scholarship reserved for black applicants.
She does this almost as an innocent. In some ways, she's accepted the idea that she's half Creole. She doesn't really see that as a scam, possibly until later. I mean, is this a case then of appreciation or appropriation?
You know, again, I also subscribe, like Tristan does, to the theory of ambiguity and complexity, and I try to make my characters' motives and their actions reflect that. So to me, I think it's something of an open question, although while there is an innocence to her actions, I think beneath that there's a deeper awareness of what she's doing is certainly problematic. It's a tough call. You know, she on one hand would claim that, you know, while she is taking on the mantle of blackness, she's doing it without an awareness of what it really represents historically, but that is not entirely sincere on her part. There's a lot of rhetoric that she takes on about the universality of art and blackness, you know, as a metaphor for all humanity and all of this kind of thing. But on a deeper level, I think she knows what she's doing and does it anyway.
Well, let me ask you now. You're Jewish. You've written a book about called The End of the Jews, which is all playing, as we've been talking here, with how is culture, how is identity and culture created? How is it manufactured? How it is inherited? What about you? Did you get involved in hip-hop like one of your characters? Have you been involved in this very same divide of which you write?
Yeah, hip-hop was the music that I grew up listening to and the culture I grew up involved in from a pretty young age. And I got involved in the music in the mid-80s at a time when hip-hop was very overtly political, was very concerned with addressing social inequality, and it was a music that really I took to very quickly and very fully and became really one of the main ways that I understood the world was through this music. And I started a hip-hop magazine when I was in college, which was a commercial venture. It was on newsstands for a couple of years. My previous novel, Angry Black White Boy, is a satire about race, whiteness, and hip-hop. And I do a lot of public speaking about these issues and about the way that they come together in American life, the way a new racial paradigm is or is not being created through hip-hop and the way that white kids have identified with it and the limitations of that. So it's an issue that I've been engaged in for a very long time. By the same token, you know, I write a good bit about jazz in the book, and I was a roadie for 6 years for a jazz drummer, the great late Elvin Jones. So all of this is, you know, reflective in some ways of my own background.
Novelist Adam Mansbach. His book is The End of the Jews. Well, that's it this week for Writer's Voice. Please join us next week when we talk with Rabi Alamedine about his wonderful new novel, The Hakawati. We also hear from Greg Mitchell of the trade magazine editor and publisher about his new book, So Wrong for So Long, How the Press, the Pundits, and the President Failed on Iraq. Find out more about Writer's Voice and upcoming authors at our website, writersvoice.net. You can leave your comments there and stream or download past shows. You can also subscribe to our podcast. Thanks for listening. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.